And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. On today's morning show, we're going to be meeting a gentleman by the name of Sammy Weber, who is visiting the campus of Carthage this week at the invitation of the Clausen Center. Sammy Weber is from the nation of Cameroon. That is where I believe he was born and raised and lives and works. And the primary focus of Mr. Weber's efforts are to work with impoverished people in Cameroon, and also trying to not only help make the lives of poor people better, but also endeavoring to address some of the systemic issues that cause poverty in a place like Cameroon, trying to address some of those most fundamental causes of poverty. Sammy Weber has been visiting a number of different classes on the campus of Carthage, and he's also going to be giving a public address tonight between 6 and 7 in the Todd Weir Center, room 128. So for anybody who is interested in hearing more from Sammy Weber on this really important topic, the public is warmly invited to that address again tonight between 6 and 7 in the Todd Weir Center. And Sammy Weber, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. It's good to be here, Greg.
Glad that you can be here. One of the things I should say, since this is a radio program and nobody is seeing you the way I am, is that just to look at you, of course, we wouldn't assume that you are a native of the nation of Cameroon in the continent of Africa. You are Caucasian. So explain a little bit about the circumstances under which you were born in Cameroon.
Yeah, and actually, if I were wanting people on the radio to think differently, I could also speak in my Cameroonian accent, which when I'm in Cameroon, I normally talk in my Cameroonian accent to my brothers and sisters there in Cameroon. And but like you brought up, I'm white, I'm Caucasian, and my father is from Canada, from British Columbia, Canada, and my mother is from United States, from Iowa. And I was born and raised in Cameroon. My parents were working for an organization called Lutheran Bible Translators, and my father translated the New Testament into a language called Kwanja from 81 to 2003. He was working on the Bible translation project. So I'll switch back into my white accent again, but that's just to show you a little bit. I'm kind of a blend of cultures, and I've spent about altogether 8 years here in the United States, some of that for college in Chicago, but I've spent most of my life in Cameroon.
Wow. Tell us a little bit about growing up in Cameroon. First of all, in what kind of a community did you grow up? I mean, was it a very small community, small village, or was it more like a city? And what, for instance, was your schooling, and who were your friends? What was life for a youngster growing up in Cameroon?
So I grew up in a small village, about 500 people, where everybody knew everybody and everybody knew everybody's business. And my siblings and I were the only white kids for 100 miles squared. So that meant that we definitely stood out. And it was sort of like growing up in a fishbowl in some ways. You had people constantly watching you and making observations. And whatever was your habit, it was assumed that that is what white people do. So if you did something that was a little unusual, people would say, well, white people do such and such. Because we were the only white people that our friends and the people around us knew, which was certainly a factor in growing up. But it was a small village with no water, no running water, no electricity. So we would draw water from a well. My dad actually had some solar panels that we used for having some simple lights in our house. We had a 12-volt system in our house. So you can imagine, you know, not using a whole lot of electricity. Over the course of the year, we probably used the amount of electricity that a lot of people here would use in a day if they have a hot tub that they want to heat up. Wow. So that was different. And then, I grew up speaking a language called Kwanja, which is the language that was spoken in our particular part of Cameroon. But there's 280 languages in Cameroon that are as different from each other as English and German.
Wow.
And so we would communicate using French and African English as the two national languages that we use to communicate. And then there's also a language called Fofolde, which we use for trade a lot in Cameroon. And that is a local language that is more widespread.
Wow. Say a word about the work that your parents were doing as Bible translators in Cameroon. And I guess part of my question is what brought them to Cameroon to do that specific work? And I'm also curious why they needed to be in Cameroon. Why did they need to live there in order to do that work? Because you're not describing them as missionaries as such, but maybe that was at least an element in the work that they were doing as Bible translators.
Yeah, so missionary is now used more as kind of a wider title. So it would be like saying you're in the medical profession, and then there's a lot of different subgroups under that. And so Bible translation is a type of missionary work, but technically they are linguists. And my parents both have masters in linguistics, and they came in, first of all, to do language development of the Kwanja language. So before they came, the Kwanja language had never been written down. There was no alphabet. And so they analyzed the sound system in 82. They created an alphabet, and then they got together all the chiefs of the different Kwanja villages and presented the alphabet to them and said, are you okay with this being the alphabet for your language? And the chiefs agreed that this was a good thing, and they wanted their language to be written down, and this was a good alphabet. And so they began then to teach people to read and write within their own language, which gives people of that tribe a real pride in their identity and in their culture. And then from that, then they could begin Bible translation, because you can't write anything down in the language until you have a written system. And so in Bible translation, it's kind of a complex process where you're looking at the Greek original New Testament, you're looking at commentaries, and then you're trying to capture the meaning of the Greek the best you can in the local language. And in some cases, you'll end up with a better translation than what is in English, because at times you'll have something that can be better transferred from Greek to that language than transferred from Greek to English. So there's going to be certain expressions or certain instances where that local language, that tribal language, may be closer to the culture of 2,000 years ago in the Middle East than perhaps the Western culture that we have here in the West.
Certain examples, certain images or metaphors or something might actually be a more natural fit with the language you're describing versus our own modern English, for instance.
Yeah, that's correct.
Fascinating. Growing up in Cameroon, in this small village, it's obviously, I would assume, pretty much the only world you ever knew, unless you were traveling back from time to time to Canada or Iowa. How mindful were you and your siblings of this very unusual childhood? I mean, usual, normal for you, but very uncommon, very different from the way a lot of other children grew up whose parents are from Canada and Iowa. How conscious of you were you of that, if at all?
Yeah, I spent kindergarten, fourth grade, and 10th grade in Canada. And those were the furlough years for my parents. And it was in those years that my siblings and I noticed that we were different. We noticed that there was something maybe different about us that was related to the missionary work that our parents did. The rest of the time, it was more that we were different because we were white. We were different because we had some American culture elements. But we enjoyed blending in with our friends, doing the same things, going fishing, going hunting, I spoke Kwanja without an accent because I grew up speaking it. And so I prided myself that at night I could be talking to somebody in Kwanja and the people next to us wouldn't know that it wasn't a Kwanja person speaking. So there was certainly an element of feeling different but also wanting to fit in. As a kid, you want to be like your friends. And interestingly enough, as a kid, I was always upset that we were too rich. and wanted to be more poor because my friends were poor. And I don't know if I actually had reasoned through all of what that would actually look like, but there was that sense of wanting to be more poor like my friends.
For the sake of fitting in with your friends.
For the sake of fitting in and being the same as them.
Wow. And so you were, in a sense, at least to some extent, conscious, self-conscious of how much your family had compared to the families of your friends.
Yeah,
and that
exactly.
was something that made you uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Very interesting. It sounds like, for the most part, you fit in very well, had friends, and so on. We sometimes here in America, particularly, or I should say, I know this is true in America because this is where I live, and this is where I grew up, that kids can be different as they grow up, and in certain ages, everybody is sort of friends and comfortable. And then at certain points, kids start to behave differently, maybe more protective, more they can be unkind to one another and suspicious of people who are different. Things change. But by and large, in all of the time you spent living in Cameroon as a young person, did you feel like you were welcomed and comfortable there? Did it feel like home?
Yeah, I would say it did very much feel like home. I think it was harder for me when I was here in the West. Particularly fourth grade was a hard time for me making friends. I had a very different worldview. And in some ways, you might say that I had grown up faster than my peers. And so when I was in fourth grade, I didn't really have a lot in common with a lot of my peers. The subjects that I would want to talk about, I could more easily talk about with adults than with my fellow fourth graders. And so that was a challenge at that time. But in Cameroon, I would say I really did fit in. I was generally popular because of being white, but at the same time picked on more because of being white. So in some ways, I think later in life, I realized that made me more defensive than perhaps necessary, and I had to kind of work on that. But that's something that, in my childhood, I just got used to. And you kind of, over time, get used to what to expect, what your givens are, and then you work with that. But I have... I had a lot of close friends, and one of them I'm still working with today, where we're doing development work together. I formed a lot of lifelong friendships in my childhood with my fellow Cameroonians.
Mm-hmm. For those of you just joining us, my guest today on the morning show is Sammy Weber. He is visiting Carthage this week at the invitation of the Clausen Center. Sammy Weber is from the African nation of Cameroon. That is where he grew up, and he has done a great deal of work there with the poor people of Cameroon and concerned about addressing the issues of poverty on a more systemic level. He's going to be speaking tonight at Carthage between 6 and 7 o'clock in the Todd Weir Center. Sammy Weber, let's find out a little bit about the nation of Cameroon itself. And I must confess, although I'm not terrible at world geography the way some people are, I must confess that I'm not certain exactly where Cameroon is on the African continent. Tell us where it is located. Help us sort of situate it in our minds. And tell us more then about the nation as a whole before we start talking about some of the issues that you have been working on in Cameroon.
Yeah, so Cameroon is in West Central Africa. It's right next to Nigeria. So if you know where Nigeria is, it's right there, kind of in the crook of Africa, after the hump before it goes down on the west coast. So,
and it's on the coast?
Yes.
Okay.
And then it has some coast, so it has a little bit of coast, but we're working mainly more inland. About 23 million people. Size-wise, it's about the size of California, although it feels a lot bigger than that because of the condition of the roads. So if I were to travel from the southernmost part of Cameroon to the northernmost part, I can expect to spend at least 4 days in that travel because of the condition of roads. So there, if you have a paved road with one lane going one way and one lane going the other, that's about as nice of a freeway as you're going to get. If it doesn't have any potholes, then you're grateful for that. So that's kind of a little bit about the condition of the roads. It's a poor country. not the poorest in Africa. There are certainly other countries like Mali and Chad that are poorer than Cameroon, but it certainly is poor. One thing that's striking about Cameroon is that they're very rich in resources. They have a lot of resources, like they have a lot of lumber, a lot of coffee, cocoa, palm oil, and rubber and other resources, but most of those resources are being shipped out of the country in the raw form, which of course contributes to the poverty level in Cameroon. So that's a little bit about the country. It's very diverse, as I mentioned earlier, very diverse linguistically, with 280 distinct languages in the country, and those are each of those represent different tribes, each with their own kind of music, their own drum beat, their own type of dance. And while there's similarity between those different cultures, they each do have kind of their own unique subculture.
How would you describe then the way a given person in Cameroon, depending on which tribe they belong to, feels about Cameroon as a whole? I mean, generally speaking, where does their allegiance lie, and from what do they really derive their most powerful sense of identity? I mean, are they first and foremost a Cameroonian, or are they first and foremost a member of their own particular tribe?
I think about half of Cameroon's population lives in cities, and I think that most of the people in the cities, their first identity would probably be as Cameroonians. And the other half of the population that lives in more rural areas, I would say their primary identity is probably to their tribal roots. And so that is, as we're seeing urbanization happen, that is slowly changing kind of where people's identity lies. And there's a lot more intermarriage in the cities between different tribes, whereas in the rural areas, people are more likely to marry someone from their own tribe.
I'm just looking up here. I don't want to pretend like I knew this off the top of my head, but it looks like the capital city of Cameroon is a city of Yaoundé?
Yeah, that's correct, Yaoundé.
With a population of more than 2 million people.
Yeah.
So if we were to walk down the sidewalks or drive down the streets of Yaoundé, what would we see? In what way would that be both similar and dissimilar to a similar size city here in the United States, for instance?
Well, you would see you'd see a lot of traffic jams because the city's grown faster than the government's been able to keep up with in terms of infrastructure. You would see a lot of people walking because people walk a lot in within the city, getting places. If it's less than a mile away, they're not likely to take a taxi. You would see half of the vehicles are yellow taxis. So people are vehicles are being used a lot more efficiently there, and maximum capacity oftentimes. In a taxi, you would be getting two people in the front seat next to the driver, and 3 to 4 people in the back.
Wow!
But taxis less expensive there than it would be here, partly for that reason. You would see a certain amount of garbage on the streets, but not as much as it used to be because the government has been putting now garbage bins out where people can start throwing that and collecting it. So it's improving, but certainly more than here. There's not as much of a public mentality of littering being a bad thing. And so that's something that's slowly changing. You would, as far as weather is concerned, you'd be walking in something between 80 and 95 degree weather. Most of the time, pretty much all year round. In the early mornings, it may get down to 70 degrees, and then we all huddle around a fire because we think that's cold. Other than that, it's pretty warm, and there's not a huge amount of fluctuation in temperature. So once you get used to that temperature, it's fairly comfortable because that's what it is pretty much year round.
And I'm thinking if Cameroon is adjacent to Nigeria, then doesn't that place you quite close to the equator?
Yeah, we are 6 degrees north of the equator.
Wow, there we go. And in a major city like Yaoundé then, I mean, would we see a McDonald's or any other signs of the West in that sort of commercial sense? Or would we have a definite sense that we were someplace other than the West?
Well, you would certainly know that you were in somewhere other than the West. In fact, it reminds me of a friend of mine from here who came to visit, and after about 24 hours there, I looked over at her and said, you look like you're kind of in a daze. And she said, I just keep on saying to myself, Dorothy, you're not in Kansas anymore. And that definitely, you would get that sense if you're in Cameroon. You wouldn't see McDonald's or Burger King or anything like that. You might see some European or French stores that, since France colonized much of Cameroon, but it would be different if you went inside. They may not have everything on the menu. They may not be able to give you your order in the same amount of time as you may have expected. But those are some cultural differences that you would notice. But there's more of French influence, but not really a lot of American things that you would see.
Interesting. Before we get to the work that you're doing in Cameroon with the poor, I want to understand better what your relationship is with Cameroon now. It sounds like it is not where you live year-round anymore. Maybe you could sketch for us, once you kind of passed childhood and reached, I don't know, the ages 16, 17, 18 or something, where did life take you from there? And in this period of your life, what has your relationship to Cameroon been?
Yeah, so I wanted to do missionary work from early on, and wanted to have an impact on the world around me. And I thought that the best way to do that would be to go into a country that would be very hard to access, like maybe North Korea or somewhere like that. Wow. So when I was going to college in Chicago, that was my thought of going to a place like that. But there came a point in time in which, just really during a time of prayer, God impressed on my heart that he wanted me instead to go back to the country where I had a lot of experience already, and to not only do missionary work, but to train others in missionary work and in holistic development work. And from that time on, that's what I've been headed towards. I hadn't been expecting to go back to Cameroon when I left there for college. But it did certainly help me to go back to a place where I already had 20 years of experience. And going back there, I've been working there since 2009, so 10 years now. And every 2 to 3 years, my wife and I and our kids take a several-month break and come here to the States. So we are just finishing a 3-year term there, and we got back here Tuesday, just a week and a day ago, and we're going to be here for 9 months and then be going back to Cameroon for another 3-year term. So we are based there, you could say full-time, or more permanently, that's more permanent address. But we come back here to the States both to give our kids kind of a taste of what American culture is like. We would like them to, you know, have the choice as they grow up of where they want to live. And then also because we're connecting with people who support us financially, we're connecting with people who pray for us, and that's also important to us in what we do.
So the heart and soul of at least much of your work in Cameroon involves working with the poor. So let's begin by maybe understanding just how poor a nation we are talking about, and maybe how poor the poor people of Cameroon are. I mean, what kind of poverty that we are talking about. You already mentioned, I think, that at least overall, Cameroon as a nation is not one of the poorer nations in Africa. There are other places that feel much more, in a sense, acute deprivation on a national scale. But otherwise, what kind of poverty in Cameroon are we generally talking about, and what sector of the population is generally most directly affected by it?
I would say that those who are probably suffering the most are children and youth, and then also sometimes elderly, especially if there wasn't a lot of if they didn't put money aside during their working time. As far as level of poverty, the average income in Cameroon is somewhere between $1,000 a year and $2,500, depending on which statistics you look at and what part of Cameroon you're looking at. My wife and I had the conviction to live as the poor among the poor. That is to say, to live with a budget that is more similar to the people that we're serving than a lot of other people who do similar kinds of work. Partly because we felt that if we're really going to address some of these problems, we have to be able to feel the problems from the inside to understand them. So when we're in Cameroon, we live on a budget of about 150,000 CFA, which is about $300 a month. And within that budget, we are able to kind of feel some of the needs that some of our friends and people we're ministering to also have. But that puts us in the upper middle class in Cameroon in terms of at least for our area. There's parts of cities where that would be maybe middle class or lower middle class. But in our particular area, that puts us in the upper middle class. And so that's one way that we're able to then understand some of the issues that somebody faces. For instance, one of your kids gets sick and you're not right away going to take them to the hospital. You're going to first of all say, well, you know, if I can guess what sickness this is, and if I can get the treatment for this, maybe I can self-diagnose, and maybe it's just a virus. So let's wait a day or two and see if the kid gets sicker, because you don't want to spend money if you don't absolutely have to. And if it's going to be something that's going to resolve itself, then, you know, you don't want to. But of course, making that decision might mean that the sickness gets a lot worse and you end up spending more money at the hospital. So those are decisions you have to wrestle with when you're crunching the numbers and your budget. And then you have to decide, am I going to buy food in bulk? That seems more expensive initially. But then if you work the numbers and realize that in the long run, if you buy something different in bulk each month, you can actually save a lot of money. Those are decisions that we try to make in order to model for other people who are facing some of the same challenges, how they can make do with a little less money, because that's a reality that most people are facing.
Right. So speaking of reality then, so in fact, you and your wife, you and your family have more money than the typical family in Cameroon has, but you choose to, in a sense, sequester probably a lot of the money that you have and live within a strict budget that more closely reflects what real life is like for a lot of the people in Cameroon.
Yeah, so what we do is we just take more of what is given us as a stipend and we put it towards our work rather than towards our personal budget while we're there. And that allows us to help more people than we would otherwise be able to do. So that's an added plus of doing it that way. But then when we come here to the States, we just we go back to taking the full amount that we're being given, just so that we can pay the rent. And, you know, obviously here you're not going to pay your rent with $300 a month. So
not very likely, yes. So in a nation like Cameroon, is there a safety net in place, a social safety net, as we refer to it in the United States, to take care of people who, for one reason or another, cannot work, for instance, or are quite elderly without family? Or, I mean, does such a safety net exist in a place like Cameroon, or are people left entirely to their own devices to survive?
There are social safety nets, not political ones. So you're not usually going to look to the government for those kinds of things, although if you are handicapped, there are funds that the government gives to, for instance, someone who can't walk is likely to be able to get a bicycle that they can use their hands to get around on that bicycle. So there are certain things like that the government does provide. But in general, you're going to be dependent on your family and extended family. And there is a strong ethic of sharing, a strong idea that you need to be generous, you need to help each other out. And when one person gets a job and starts to move ahead, then they will be using often half of what they're making to support other people and their family. Hmm. And what we see is that usually if the person who has a disability is generally a pleasant personality kind of person, they tend to get a lot of help. If the person has kind of made themselves a little bit annoying to their extended family,
Or feels bitter,
then over time that help can dwindle out and they can be in rather severe poverty as a result.
Right. So the talk that you're going to be giving at Carthage, and I know a lot of what you have talked about in visiting classes and so on, has been about addressing poverty at the systemic level. And the title of your talk, at least as I saw it, made reference to broken systems and how there are certain broken systems that are really the primary driver of poverty. What kind of broken systems are we talking about here? And what is the nature of the brokenness that you are wanting to address?
The broken systems really refers to a number of different factors in society in Cameroon. And again, I make some critique of Cameroon partly because I'm part of that society. But in Cameroon, there are cultural norms that influence poverty. For example, there's to some degree a culture that celebrates death more than it celebrates life. And when I say that, it's because we have, when someone dies, the funeral is a fairly lengthy time of mourning that you have for the person who died. And culturally, you're expected to attend funerals not only of your immediate family, but also extended family and sometimes fairly distant relatives. Hmm. Now, if you put that into the equation of, you know, people are coming from large families, and so you have a lot of brothers and sisters and a lot of cousins. And you could very, if you were to really live up to the cultural expectations, you could very easily take a month out of every work year just attending funerals and doing the proper mourning process.
Wow.
And so, you know, anything that limits the amount of work being done in a country obviously also has some impact on the economy. A social system that and something that is in the kind of in the social culture is the expectation of generosity, which is really good on the one hand. I call it African socialism. It's not a political socialism. It is really just the social expectations that someone lives with. It's good on the one hand in that the people who are really at the lowest point in society are being helped. On the other hand, it also kills incentive to work really hard for people who are already maybe not inclined towards a strong work ethic because they expect that whether they work or not, somebody else is going to work and help them out. Another way that it affects people is that, like my colleague Bruno, who he and I work together and we have the same basic income that we're using, but half of his income is going to go to his extended family every month. And what that means is that he's not able to save up money to get capital to start something that could eventually give him, he could probably double his income in a place like Cameroon within 10 years if he was able to hold on to capital. But he feels very obligated culturally to not hold on to any amount of capital when there are urgent needs being brought to him, or at least seemingly urgent needs. And as a Christian, he feels the need to meet those needs in the immediate. And one thing that we do is trying to orient people towards the idea that, yes, we certainly should be generous, and we certainly should value other people as people who also bear the image of God. But sometimes we can position ourselves to actually help others more if we're able to say no in the initial needs and are able to work up a little bit of capital to start systems that will provide ongoing income rather than just meeting the symptom of the problem.
Hmm. Do you see any sort of happy medium there in which people could continue to be generous, but maybe not to quite the same extent, or try to make certain hard choices that I'm going to give you just a little bit less so I can take some of this money and try to plant the seed for this other possibility that could benefit all of us in a really big way. Is that kind of what you're thinking?
Yeah, I think that oftentimes when possible, we prefer to spend money helping somebody use a resource that they already have that they didn't know that they had and help them use it in a better way so that they themselves can have the pride and joy of pulling themselves out of their situation with a resource that is already available to them. So an example would be, for instance, if there's a coffee farmer who has been growing coffee and selling his coffee berries at a very low price, and somebody in his family gets sick and he comes to us and he needs money in order to cover the medical bills, we would prefer, rather than giving him the money directly, to say, all right, if you and some of the other members of your family can come and we'll show you how you can turn those coffee berries into roasted ground coffee, and we can package it because we already have packaging for coffee ready with a small company that we started there. And then that will be this value, which is maybe twice, three times the amount he would be getting from his coffee berries, which will more than cover the medical bills and also leave him with a little bit of savings.
Interesting. So in a sense, you feel like part of what you want to do is to get people thinking, I'm not sure what the word is, more capitalistically maybe, maybe thinking about ways in which they can advance their own personal situation and circumstances.
Yeah, I don't think I guess coming back to your earlier question, I wouldn't lay out exact principles for how generous to be. I think those are decisions that somebody has to make with their conscience in a situation by situation level. What we're trying to see is orient people towards more long-term thinking and also orienting people towards more of a better usage of what resources are already available, especially unused resources. We think that those two things can really make it possible. I would say that, you know, capitalism has its weakness, socialism has its weakness. I'm not going to pretend to give the exact formula for what balance between the two needs to take place. But there does need to be some positive capitalistic ideas implemented, while also a continuing ethic of generosity.
Right. I think one thing that's interesting to think about here is if there are ways in which what you are urging your friends in Cameroon to do is, in a sense, swimming against the cultural tides that are most familiar to them and also a part of who they are. And as you've already touched on, it's also part of what you love about Cameroon and its people. Do you feel like there's kind of a tricky balancing act in that respect in terms of wanting to, in a sense, change the situation of people's lives in Cameroon without, in a sense, changing themselves?
Yeah, I think that one thing is that a lot of what we do is asking questions. I think sometimes when you ask the right questions in a culture or in a problem situation, it allows people to maintain their identity and their some of their cultural values, but to wrestle with those questions. And the solution that they may come up with may be different from what I would propose if I were to just try and bring a solution to that problem. But it's orienting people in kind of which questions may be helpful for them to ask. And it certainly is a challenge. We believe that God has beautiful things in the African culture and the Cameroonian culture that don't exist in the American culture. We're certainly not out to make Cameroonians to become like Americans. That's not our goal in the least. But when people are suffering from hunger, from malnutrition, from disease, when people want to go to school and can't afford it, these are real needs and these are real people. And we want to see them have the resources to be able to pursue those dreams that we believe God has given them in their hearts. And I think a lot of that is helping them ask the right questions, helping them use resources. And another broken system that I didn't refer to earlier is really a moral issue in Cameroon. The United Nations did a survey of countries around the world to kind of gauge corruption. And in year 2000 and 2001, Cameroon was listed as the most corrupt country in the world.
Really?
Since then, and I think Nigeria has been beating us on that front. But we have a lot of corruption. And I think actually I laugh when I think about the United Nations Committee because they were offered a bribe at the airport when they came. And that probably slanted their view from the beginning. But nonetheless, In Cameroon, if you're, say, a driver of a vehicle in a rural area, if you have all your papers in order, that's one option. Or you could have a 500-franc bill, and that's another option. And even if you do have your papers in order, you probably will end up having to give that 500-franc bill as well, or at least a lot of the time that will be the case. At a checkpoint where you'll be stopped by police. So that's just a part of Cameroonian life. And the corruption isn't just at the level of the government. A lot of people criticize the government. I think a lot of Cameroonians who come here to the United States do this as well. There's a lot of criticism of the president and of the higher levels of government. But I think that if we're honest with ourselves within Cameroon society, we'll realize that all the things that we critique at the higher levels of government are things that happen at a smaller level, at the lowest level of society. People borrowing money and not paying it back, people cheating one another, people stealing. The level of theft is very high. And if you're a small business owner and you have to spend, say, 30% of your profits on security measures, that certainly affects your overall ability to make money. And that's a reality in Cameroon where for so many businesses, I don't know a single businessman in Cameroon who hasn't been robbed at least once.
Wow.
And quite often it's by somebody who was close to them, somebody that was a brother, a friend, a person that they trusted. Hmm. And so there's some moral issues there, and those moral issues have huge economic impact. And that's one of the things that we do as well, is talking to people about what morality is. A saying that resonates with a lot of Cameroonians, a lot of Cameroonians would agree to, is the statement, "I'm too poor to be honest." And we often try to reorient people from that mentality and say, no, actually, it doesn't work that way. You need honesty first, and from there, you can work your way up. And so that's something that we do by teaching principles in the Bible and by introducing people to who Jesus is. That's the way that we look at that particular problem, as is doing what we call the life and life discipleship, because we see as somebody's worldview changes, as their understanding of life changes, as they see themselves as image bearers, that is, bearers of the image of God, that changes then how they are going to treat themselves and treat other people. So that's how we address that specific root of poverty, of the moral issue in Cameroon.
Interesting.
As a team.
How does this seem applicable to other nations in Africa? Or is Cameroon a very unique situation, and do we need to be careful about making generalities about how these lessons might be applied in other places?
Well, I would say when talking about issues like poverty, there's certainly we're going to be making some generalizations regardless. Obviously, not every Cameroonian is prone to dishonesty or corruption. That's certainly not true. I know quite a number of Cameroonians who are very honest and forthright individuals. And again, across Africa, you're going to have a certain amount of diversity. But one thing I would say is that for the African countries that I've been to or where I've talked to other people in development work, Rwanda, Togo, Nigeria, those are the countries that I've been to for more than a week, where I can say I had a little bit of time to gauge the culture a little bit. And then for a number of other African countries where I've met people from there, one thing that would be true in each of these countries is that there are a lot of resources, and those resources are not being used as well as they could be. So Cameroon, I think, has the potential to be a very wealthy country with all of the resources that they have. And I think that once the moral problem changes significantly, then a lot of other things are going to change as well. And one thing that our I mentioned earlier we started a small company, and one thing that we do is we show people how to take products from the raw form to a more refined form. So we have coffee, we have honey, we have cocoa that we turn into chocolate. We have moringa trees where we grind the powder of the leaves, and that's great for malnutrition and has a lot of real nutritional value. We have just a bunch of different products where we're showing people through our doing it as a business, which generates money for the people that we help. We also are showing people that they can do the same thing. And I think there just needs to be more of that across Africa.
Right. And when you're saying we, who is we?
My wife and I and my teammate, Ngauna Jean Bruno, who is a childhood friend of mine in Cameroon, and his wife, Florence. So there's four of us as core members of the team. And then we have 12 members of the board of the small company who are local people who we know, both Muslims and Christians, both younger people and older people are on the board giving their contributions to how to run the company.
Fascinating. Well, this has been such an intriguing conversation, and I am most intrigued by what you've had to share and your perspective on some of these very, very important issues. We want to remind our listeners that you're going to be speaking tonight at Carthage College tonight at 6 or shortly after 6 in the Todd Weir Center. That is room 128 A and B, and this is a talk free and open to the public. You can hear more from Sammy Weber and the work that he is doing in the nation where he was born and raised, Cameroon. Sammy Weber, it's been great to meet you today on the morning show, and I thank you for making time in your very busy schedule at Carthage to be part of the morning show today, and wish you well in the work that you do.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
Sammy Weber, our guest on today's morning show here on WGTD. Tomorrow on the morning show, we're going to be talking with Jim Schatzman from the Choral Arts Society of Southeastern Wisconsin about their next concert, which is devoted to the music of the Beatles. And on Friday, it is the monthly visit of Brian Albrecht, the president of Gateway Technical College. And with him will be the gentleman who is scheduled to be the commencement speaker for Gateway's commencements exercises next week. On Monday, we'll be hearing from Jack Rose from the National Alliance for Mental Illness. On Tuesday, we're going to be hearing about an event called Over the Rainbow, which involves aerial arts. And it is a wonderful, spectacular visual feast if you've never seen aerial arts. We'll be talking about that on Tuesday. On Wednesday, Dr. James Kinchin, Director of Choral Activities at the University of Wisconsin Parkside, talking about a very exciting project that he is involved in. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website, wgtd.org. And you can also subscribe to The Morning Show as a podcast. And you can subscribe via Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, or Spotify. Look for The Morning Show under the name Morning Show with Greg Berg and subscribe. And you can hear The Morning Show not just Monday through Friday, but actually 7 days a week. We're approaching 9 o'clock.